Session number 12713, Mr. Tommy Temple, Reel 16.
Mr. Temple, Reel 16. You said you were supervised by civilians. How did they treat you?
Well, the civilians were quite good, really. Whilst we didn't get anything from them, there was a kindness of a kind, not material kindness. They could always talk in this pigged-in German that we used to get up, and we could make ourselves understood in German. They couldn't make themselves understood in English. After all, why they should be? It was their country. It was us who used to have to try to pick up a little bit here to make us understood. But we got on very well with them, very well with them indeed. In fact, there was a young kid came up to me one day and he said, Glenn Miller. Well, I hadn't any idea who Glenn Miller was. I mean, I'd been out of the country for about 7 years or something. And I had no idea who he was. I mean, somebody talked about Vera Lynn being his forces sweetheart. I'd never even heard of her. And I said, call one of the other blokes who, you know, who hadn't been abroad as long as me. She said, oh, Glenn Miller. He said, oh, he's a big orchestra leader. And we got the information from this young lad that he'd been killed in an air crash. You know, fancy this sort of thing happening. Little bits of information used to filter through from, like, this youngster as to what the position was with the war. But it was, if he was ever caught talking to us in that tent from a wireless, we tried. One of the blokes did try to ring up a catch whisker, but we had no success with it at all. And we didn't have the sort of innovative blokes who were there able to try to build up a set from a couple of valves or whatever. So we relied on more information coming from the Germans, but it was very few and far between. But basically, I think the time that we were there, we got on fairly well with them. It was quite good.
And the guards, how many guards did you have?
Well, we used to have, I think it was only about two or three guards used to take two groups. One was went to Concordia factory, and we were working at Anhalt. There was maybe two guards with each party. They used to just wander around the factory all day. I mean, to all intents and purposes, had we been any really equipped and hadn't been right in the centre of Germany, it would have been an ideal situation to have escaped, because there was only two, there was nothing else to stop us. And a couple of the lads did do that, but they didn't get far, because you couldn't travel that very far without being picked up. We gave it up as a bad job, really, towards the end, in the end of the day. Although we did try it when we got on the march, three of us did try it. But again, it was one of those things that we were too closely watched. But we never had any bother with those either. The only problem that we sometimes used to get was with the SS. They were purely and simply sent round just to have a look at the camp, see what was going on, and ask a few questions of us, see what sort of thing that was going on. And silly men, really, you know, because we had access to, I say, the machine shop in the factory, which was turning out all sorts of things with their engineers, and we could make whatever thing we liked. These fellows used to come around, oh, we're confiscating all your knives, you're not allowed to have knives. Well, we're just making them for eating purposes, you know. Well, the silly men didn't realise we're going back to the factory the next day and just making another bundle for us. You know, stupid things, irritating things, but they didn't irritate us. They must have thought it did. Well, it didn't. We were just going back to the factory and made another couple of dozen. The material was there, the means were there. Sharpener, we never thought about tagging anybody with them.
There's no cruelty that they saw from
them? No. As I say, this was the only thing that we ever had with this visit by the... this was not, I wouldn't say frequent, but an occasional visit, just... You were never told it was there. Even the German in charge of the camp, and he was a sergeant from... He'd been on the Russian front for some time. He came back wounded. And they wouldn't even tell him. He had nothing. He used to come in the black cars and the big coats and the hats and wander in, just have a talk. And mind, one fella that came, Harry, his English was perfect. Absolutely perfect. And we ventured a question to him. We said, where did you learn your English? Well, he said he was in England before the war, and his wife is English. Well, I said, where is she now? She said, still in England. He said, I'm only hoping that things go well with me. Perfect Oxford English. and he was the bloke that was asking all the questions. After, I suppose, official interpreter. Where they came from, I think we couldn't tell. Probably Leipzig or somewhere like that, or Halle, Hamburg. God knows where they actually came from, but his English was impeccable, absolutely perfect. But we tried to get news from him, like, but he says more than what his job was worth. It was at this stage, of course, where things were beginning to get hot for them, and I think he would have done if he'd been able to get away with it. He says more than my life's worth to give you information.
Did you get any visits from Red Cross people?
Yes, they used to come purely about once a year, well, at least twice a year, to the main camp. I never got a visit in the working camp, mind. But in the main camp, yes, they used to come and ask questions. Quite freely, the blokes used to give their answer about cruelty, what sort of food that they get, and we used to tell them it was... I couldn't find anything wrong about the camp. Let's face it, we were prisoners. I mean, anybody who was expecting five-star treatment in a place like that, I mean, we never gave them five-star treatment when we kept them in the desert or whatever. You were the last person thought of in the nation. The nation comes first. And if anybody understood this, then obviously the treatment that we got was reasonable. There was only one odd bod. He was one of the original black shirt members, and he used to pull out a revolver now and again to try to fight the blokes to work harder. And the blokes used to tell him to get stuffed. He didn't know what they were talking about. Like, he just walked away from him. But he didn't do anything. There was no belting somebody with sticks and staves. He tried to threaten the lads with his revolver once or twice, and we just reported him to the Lager Major, we used to call him. He said this Feldwebel, the sergeant, and he went to the factory and had a bone. He said, next time you do it, you'll go to prison, and that was it. We never got any more. This sergeant, he was kind-hearted himself. Again, considering that we were prisoners, he used to look after our welfare in relation to the work that we were doing. He would make sure that they weren't putting on us and we weren't putting onto them. And incidentally, he never did find out where all these Russians were coming from. He didn't know anything about it. Again, one of these thorough Germans. I mean, you can look them blind. You really can. They're looking for the obvious. The things that stick out in their mind. Well, we used to do the unobvious and just carry the stuff straight through it into the. I mean, when you talk about tins of jam, you know, you're talking about 12 inches high and about 10 inches across. And we used to hide them beneath the coal. The bags of flour that we used to put in was had, and on the top was the old coal ration we used to fetch in. They never thought, they're coal, it's all right. They never thought that was going on. As I said, the French and the other people were getting in blame for it. We weren't. It wasn't the British troops who were too honest to do things like this. There was no one, Harry, not that I saw.
You mentioned the fact that you had to go into town with a barrel and pick up your supplies. Mm-hmm. Did you get any opportunity to contact the German civilians?
No. No, this was taboo, talking to the civilians in the town.
Did they show any animosity towards you?
Not really, because, again, it was a small town, Harry, and it hadn't suffered anything from bombing. I think they must have thought, we haven't had anything, why should we bother with them? So they never really bothered us at all. In fact, when the gunfire was heard from, you know, from afar, as it were, and they knew that our forces were approaching them fairly closely, you started getting one or two smiles from them, you know, but... Basically, they kept themselves to themselves. They were still frightened people, Harry. They really were frightened people. As I say, we used to go into two of us used to go down with a shanty, and we would go to this place where we were building, they were making the soup for us, and go further along to the bakery and get the loaves from there. And there was no question of speaking. The loaves used to just nod, like, and nod back, and that was all. But we never used to talk to them. Well, we never got the opportunity. Apart from the fact we didn't know very much fluent German. You knew enough... To get by in a long conversation, probably talking about nothing. You probably talking about an hour trying to make yourself understood. You say, we couldn't do it. They didn't have time for that. So we didn't really have a lot of contact with the people outside.
Did the guards or the German civilian workers show increasing unease or even fear as they knew the war was coming to an end?
Yes. Well, as I said, when the gunfire first started, we realised that it was our troops, so the Americans, I believe it was. It wasn't British troops, it was Americans. The attitude, although they didn't have a bad attitude, Harry, you know, so they couldn't change all that very much. And it wasn't until we went actually on the march and bumped into these other guys from Poland and Prussia, then the Eastern Germany that we're on, where there was, I said, was about 10,000. We joined just that crowd. There were just another few people more to enlarge the numbers. Where the sentries were marching alongside you, and at the finish, it wandered into the day that we crossed, I think it was the Elbe. We crossed a river to get away from the Americans, who were approaching fairly rapidly at that stage. The gunfire seemed to be getting nearer every day. And what they didn't realise when they took us over there, what they were going towards the Russians. And now they had no love for the Russians because they knew what would have happened on there. So they had no sooner. In fact, they were actually going to blow a bridge to stop the Russians from coming over. And the bloke who was in charge of the column, he must have been a general of some sort, stopped them, said, we're getting back over the other side before you blow that bridge. And they stopped them from blowing the bridge until we all, 10,000 of us, got back to the other side and blew the bridge. And we were stopping at various places out in the sticks. We never stopped in the town. We kept in the sticks all the time. And they would just go, right, we'll halt here. Well, we were fortunate and had a farmhouse nearby. We just kept in the farmhouse and found what we could for food. I mean, there was no such thing as stopping for rations, anything like that. Fortunately, the march didn't last a long time. It would have done for the folks from Prussia. But for us, it didn't last all that long. And I think one morning, the sentries just gave up the ghost, and the lads just took the rifles off them. And we went towards the river, where the bridge had been wrecked, again, blown by the Germans. But this time, it was the opposite way. It was towards the west. And we realised the American troops were at the other side, just waiting to come over. And after, we just took the rifles and bayonets off the guards and just herded them into a group all to themselves, you know. And said, right, keep an eye on them. Those who were the NCOs. This is funny enough, this is where discipline started coming back in. And those who were the other ranks, such as myself, corporal and sergeant, took charge of it until such time as we got really organised. And these were the blokes who organised the takeover, as it were, of keeping the Germans. We had no lager or anything, where to put them, anything. If there was a hut nearby, we certainly would go in there, but there was nothing. We just kept them on there. If they wanted to bugger off, that was entirely up to them. We didn't bother. In fact, I only saw about 20 that actually were taken by the American prisoners. There must have been many, many more than that. They must have just downed tools and away. Anyway, we came to this bridge, and there was almost panic stations to get over the other side of the Americans in safety, you know. And you could see what was going to happen, and you couldn't really get over the bridge. Not the way that they were going to do it. And we just saw this American tank come over the other side. And he just let blast with his machine gun. You could see it all stop, wondering what the hell had happened here. We recognised an American tank. And then whoever was commanding the tank came over to Tannoy. And he said, sit down, all of you. Just sit down where you are. You're all right now. You're safe. We'll be over as soon as we can get a bridge. But in the meantime, we're getting you back over here. So sit down. And he kept saying, sit down. So they finished the whole column, just sat down. And then they said, it's just a question of waiting until we get you over the bridge. And we're starting to do that now. Mind they did. Organisation, I've got to give it to the Americans. Our blokes would have been writing the Prime Minister somewhere, you know, and indenting for this before they could even make a move, but these guys, no. And you could get across the bridge single file if you were careful, and this is how they started doing it. The Vietnam, there's about 10,000 troops. Now, the other side, there was a truck weighed away. It was a jeep. We found out it was a jeep, and look at that. We hadn't seen these things before. Not our blokes, the other blokes had. And follow that jeep, and the column just went along into the field and went into this huge field. It was grass, fortunately, and they were just counting us off in numbers. And they would start right at the far end of the field, that number there, listen, in groups of, I think it was about 30 in a group. And so they went down the next line, and then they went down the next line. So that when they were going to move, they would take those from that and start working like in ladder fashion, you know, just backwards and forwards until they got everybody out. And each group was given a number. Now, I'm talking about, you know, just having been recaptured, this was the thoughts of the Americans. Whether they'd trained before this to do this, I don't know, but to me it was a wonderful piece of organisation. Anyway, we were herded in these groups of 30, and each had, were given a number. And when they'd finished, these trucks came down with blankets and kerosene, first on one side and down the other, just to snort the book. Notice, stay where you are, you'll get it. You'll get it, no problem. We're coming out to everybody. And they'd done that with the food and with the blankets, a couple of blankets apiece. And they said, well, you're sleeping here tonight because we've got nowhere else for you to go at the moment. We'll shift it, start moving it tomorrow morning. Again, this was over the tannoy, you know. And they said, don't forget your number because they are your plane numbers. When that number is called, regardless of where you are, that number goes here. And there was a central point where it had to report. And if you miss that number, you've missed your plane home. Well, everybody clung to each other in their 30, but it didn't happen from there. again, the bloke, just a fleet of trucks. And the 30 got into this truck. It was a truck, I'm sure it was either 20 or 30, I can't remember. Well, the whole group was in this truck. It must have taken about 30, one of the troop carriers. And they took us into the Luftwaffe barracks. But this is where the organisation that they had got tended to fall down. But when you thought about it afterwards, they didn't have sufficient rooms to say, U-30 will go in there, U-30 will go in there. They just herded a number of us together. There was no beds. I mean, it was just a question of lying on the floor. And as the blokes were being dumped, they were just saying, remember your number, it doesn't matter where you are, you can intermingle with each other. But when that number comes out, go to the guard room and report there with your equipment. That's your number. Well, if you're trying to organise 10,000 people for feeding purposes, it was ginormous. Then a young American officer came around on particular lot and said, anybody got any experience of cooking at all? None of the lads had any experience. And Harry Wilson, this pal and bloke, he was at the school with me. Harry, do you remember the school, military school? He was at the school with me. And we came very friendly on that march. He said, well, you were Russian NCO, weren't you? Well, of course, as soon as the American officer heard this, you'll do. You can help dish out the Russians and so forth, collect the Russians and so forth. So I was hooked for the job. But unfortunately, trying to cook for 10,000 until doing night shift, you had your day shift in night where they actually were split in three shifts, but I got stuck the first time with this 2 o'clock in the morning, until 10 o'clock the next morning, you know, sort and helping with the cooks and at the same time dishing out the Russians to the cooks so it would all be presented like, well, our own cooks, our own blokes. But the Americans would never put us on full rations, they always kept us on half rations because they said the food was too rich for your stomach, you know, being without food for so long. And I remember coming off that, about 10:15, and I went to the apartment room where I was staying, Harry. I said, Harry, I'm tired, I'm going out to sleep. He says, righto. So I went to sleep, and I slept there all that day, and into the next morning, they couldn't wake me up. And to finish, Harry sent for a medic, and I woke up in the hospital, and Harry. Oh, it's a wonderful sensation waking up. There's bed, sheets, pillows, bedside table with lemonade on and things. I thought, this is great. This where I finished up here, I thought it was heaven. And the doctor came around. He says, oh, you're awake. You've been asleep for about 24 hours. Oh, I said, oh. And he says, no. He said, it could be longer than that. When he started working the times out, he started asking me questions about the food I'd been eating. He said, you are suffering from malnutrition. You realise that, don't you? I said, no. He said, well, you are. Mind, I had lost a lot of weight. And he said, how long have you been in the army? I said, well, about 9 years, 7, 9 years, I think it was at the time. Because, you know, I was concluding my boy service then. Just to chit-chat, this was once they must have examined me when I was out. The nurses were building a room, you know, a couple of nurses were around them, a couple of orderlies were around them. And he said, well, how long have you been abroad? Well, I said, up to now, I think it's about 7.5 years. He says, you haven't been home in 7.5 years. I said, no. I said, the normal tour of duty for a British soldier going abroad was 6 years, which it was. But I said, because of the war, we just didn't get home. And 7.5 years. Right, he said, we'll have to do something about that. And these were still the same organisation of shipping their patients out, as well as the other ones. We were given certain numbers, you know, and saying that you would go when that was. Only theirs was hospitalised. You were going to hospital when they landed the other side, where the others were going to army camps. And he said, right, oh, I said, I'm taking a bloke off this one because he's not too well. You're going on. Big book nigger came on. He says, this is the one that makes the number up. Take him on. He's on the next flight. And I was out the hospital in the crack, no bother at all. He says, you'll be medically examined when you get to the other side. He said, and they'll tell you all about it. And I wasn't in that hospital that I know. Oh, you know, wide awake, as it were. Conscious, I wasn't in that hospital above, 2 hours before I was shipped to this airfield and came home on a decoder.
Was this an American hospital?
Well, it was, yes, it obviously must have been.
He was an American doctor?
Yeah, American doctor, American nurses. See, the nigger was there, was a big book nigger. Nice bloke and all. Nice chatty fella, you know, great guy. I must admit, they were great guys, you know. To me, they were like the guardian angel of company service, sort of. Gabriel was with the head man.
How did you feel, you being prisoner of war, 18 months, whatever it was, and the sight of the Americans on the other side of the river?
Feelings, I think, were mixed by looking at the faces of the others, Harry, but my own feeling was a bit subdued. because we still didn't know what was going to happen to us. We thought it was going to be another one of those things where you're going to have to stay for a while and see what's what. But they who tried, and in fact, I did bump into a bloke and during the course after I'd been home for some time, and he said they were at those barracks for some weeks before they eventually all got home, because, you know, when he's trying to shift 10,000 people, as well as still carrying on a war, you know, it was a terrific task that they must have had. But I was one of the fortunate ones. But the feeling I had didn't materialise until I'd got on the plane and landed in Lynham in Wiltshire. And just on my knees, just kissed the earth and say, I'm pleased to be back home, sort of thing. And the other blokes were just the same, just got off the plane and that was it. They shook hands with each other, tears were rolling down some of the faces, and they said, right, come on, along this way. Again, we were still in with the Yanks. This way, into this tent, you get deloused in here, and in that tent, you'll get some fresh clothing. And this was American clothing. What they were actually involved a shirt, a cardigan, a pair of trousers, a pair of socks, and that was it. Said you will get quit by your own people when you get to the other end. And again, the questions were asked, this, that, and you know, how long have you been, where you been? I suppose to verify, you know. We went through an interrogator, I suppose you could call it, and see what was what. And again, I was pushed ahead of the queue on a hospital train. And we travelled overnight to Wakefield in Yorkshire, Pinderfields Emergency Hospital, where we were in Bogdan Hospital there.
What date was this?
I think it was May the 8th, because someone, I remember someone said this is VE, and the next day was VE plus one. That was it was either VE or VE plus one when we arrived. And this is where the British took over. Again, but I must confess that their organisation was up to the same scratch, because they had they obviously had everything laid on for us, no doubt about it. You went in for a medical, and at the same time you were deloused again before you went in here anything. And it was all done fairly quickly. You went into the room, and then you were equipped then with battle dress. You got your quarter of two shirts, your battle dress blouse, trousers, socks, and spares. And so you had a kit bag full of the normal British Army, all brand spanking new. Size as well, I got fairly well rigged up, but obviously sizes were a bit off with some of them, but they weren't concerned about this. And we just marched, or weren't marched, we were taken to a hospital ward and said, oh, you'll be here till the medical officer comes and gives you an examination. And that wasn't till the next day. We weren't allowed out of the hospital at all, not until we'd been examined. And it was decided in my case that I would have to stay there a few weeks because I was suffering from malnutrition. And again, when being debriefed, they'd found out through my talking that I'd been abroad 7 months, and I said I would like to get home as quickly as possible, and the medical officer was listening, his colonel. He said, if you stick to the diet we'll give you, yes, we'll let you go. We'll give a couple of days to make sure that you're all right, at least fit for travelling. I said, well, fair enough. But it was then the following day that we said, now that we were properly equipped, that you could go into the town. And funnily enough, they had money changers there. Anybody who had German marks, we'd get them changed. And fortunate enough, we found a whole host of German marks. So I had quite a few to bring home. And we were only getting about tons of threats. So.
Had you been paid in some form whilst you were
working, yeah. I should have mentioned this, Harry, yes. We were paid, again, I've mentioned Lagergeld, camp money. And you were paid, I forget how much it was. And they said, well, you can save it up, you can spend it. Where we're going to spend it, like, I don't know. There was nowhere to spend the damn stuff. I mean, where could we spend it? We're in the south, you weren't allowed to go in the town. They wouldn't have accepted it anyway. But I suppose it was one of the Geneva conventions that they had to be paid for the work that we're doing, so we got paid. Phony money, I think monopoly money must have been better than this stuff. In fact, one of them said, well, look, if he'd save it up, he says he's nowhere to spend it, just save it up and he can send it to him. And funnily enough, my sister got the money I sent home. When I got back home, I said, did he get some money? Yeah, got the value for it as well.
That was exchanged
again, I think through the Swiss banks, it must have been, through the Swiss organisation, but she definitely got the money. And she was in the ATS at the time. She definitely got the money, I sent it on to her. Sent it home, like, to my mother, and then she just sent it on to Nora. The following day that we were still in this hospital living, yes, we decided to go out in the town. I wanted a haircut, because we were just chopping each other's hairs with a blunt pair of scissors, and all in a bit of a bloody mess, really. So Harry Wilson wasn't with us then. He was one of the survivors. We went and piled up with these two blokes and went to the barber shop. And barber's a couple of chairs there, you know, from Pinderfields. Right, oh, we'll do it. How do you want it cut? Not army style, you know. So he trimmed our hairs up, and we got our hands in our pockets. She says, it's all paid for, not to worry, not to worry. So we came out of there, and it was picture time, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We said, well, let's go to the pictures. And then we went after counting my work. We saw this because I fell asleep in the really pictures anyway. We went in there, and we went to the box office, and this lad said, you're from Pinfields. I said, yeah. So all right, it's all paid for. So we got in there for nothing. We came out of there and we went to this little restaurant where we got a lovely little meal. Oh, it was absolutely delightful to get back to English cooking again. Not a lot, well, we couldn't eat a lot, Harry, be honest. You know, we'd been, our stomachs had got so contracted that you just couldn't eat a lot. But it was very tasty. And we called for the bill, and the girl says, oh, it's already been paid for. Now, this sort of thing was happening wherever we went, cigarettes in the shops that's been paid for. We want to buy some sweets or buy something that's been paid for. The people of Yorkshire are absolutely marvellous, really were. We couldn't have faulted them anyway, the reception that you got when you came back, it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, they weren't having thrown parties or street things like that, or celebrations or decorations, but the attitude of the average person in Wakefield to us was absolutely superb. You couldn't have wished it better if they'd been given instructions to do it. You couldn't have. The welcome was overwhelming. The generosity was absolutely great, really splendid. We're sorry to leave it, because everything that we went to town for, we're getting out. But this only could only happen for a limited period, obviously, because I think it was 3 days later. The medical officer gives another check over. It wasn't the Colonel this time, it was another world. He said, all right, we've got your story, you're fit to go home, but here's your diet. You know, you've got to stick to this diet. If you don't, he said, you'll be finishing up in the hospital again. I said, well, fair enough. It was no sweet stuff, no fats, so very carefully monitored diet. I said, well, what about drink? He says, the best thing you can drink is Guinness. Well, I hated the bloody stuff, didn't I? But anyway, he put me on the train to, because I was living then, the family had shifted during the course of the war, and they lost a house of socials and moved to Donington, Shropshire, where the big arsenal was. The Ordnance Depot was a massive place. It was as big as bigger than the town itself. Absolutely. It's still there yet. Because they had closed Woolwich Arsenal and sent it all down in Donington. It was a massive place. I mean, the tank proving grounds must have covered about 10 or 12 acres alone, just for proving the behaviour of tanks and vehicles, you know, on their own grounds. And the sheds, they used to go from, well, you came out of Newport, which is the nearest town, and the next nearest town was Wellington. Wellington was slightly nearer. I don't know, people 50-50. And you could, when he left Newport, you could see the start of it. Now, when you were leaving to go to Wellington, then you could see that it was absolutely marvellous. A huge place. I've never seen anything as big as this. And tens of thousands of soldiers there. Tens of thousands of them. Absolutely marvellous. But I got on the train at Leeds, taken by road transport. Done a couple of changes here. It was the most uncomfortable journey. It was tightly packed. I was sitting on the toilet seat for most of the time. Until a bloke got up and an old gent got up and gave me a seat. He said, you need the seat more than I do. You see, I was a bit worried, in actual fact, because I was feeling a bit queer. And I thought, oh yeah, I've got to get home, yeah. And the last station I got out was I got out of Stafford, to change to Stafford to go down to go to Donington. And again, the porter sat us down on a seat, but there was comparatively an empty train, sat us down on a seat. I had the kit bag was the worst thing. Carry was chock-a-block with clothing. And I got to Donington, it was about four or five stops along the road, and I hadn't a clue where to go. Nobody there to meet me. For all I'd sent a telegram from the train, the Red Cross, I must admit the Red Cross here were terrific on the train, they were taking our names and addresses. Very concerned that we inform all people that we'd arrived in this country. When I just wrote a telegram, I would say, look, let's keep this brief. Arrived England, such and such a date, home as soon as possible. Well, that was it. So I sent it on, that was good enough. They were terrific with Red Cross when we arrived back. But anyway, at this station, I was absolutely lost. I hadn't a clue where I was. And I asked one soldier, he said, I haven't a clue. He said, I'm only here myself. I don't get about very much. He said, there's a newspaper shop up the road there. Just ask in there. And I went up the road to the newspaper shop and I asked, yes, they knew where it was. straight up the road here till you come to the main crossroads, and it's just the other side of the crossroads. I said, fair enough, it was a straight road. He said, but mine, it's a fair way. So I slung me bag kit back on me back. I started throwing the youngster. I could hardly walk with it. And this old chap came behind me. He said, where are you going? I told him, I was just coming home. He said, I can see that. Where are you going? I said, Southview, number 9, Southview, Donington. He said, that's okay, I know what it is. I'm going that way myself, son. He said, I'll carry a kit bag for you. So we went up there, and it must have been the best part of three quarters of a mile. I carried my kit bag, I don't suppose I would have made it. I was, you know, felt so ill. And he delivered me home, knocked at the door, and the old lady spoke to him. And I got in all the usual tears and everything else was flying about, you know, the usual. Because the old lady was the only one in. The younger sister was working away, and one sister in the ATS, my brother was still away. And she said, you know who that was you were talking to? I said, no, who, the fellow who brought you up the road and carried your kid back. She said, Mr. Sims, he lives next door. I thought, how splendid, how lucky I was to pick up a bloke like that, a kind hearted old gentleman, that he give me that lift up like that. Mind, I needed it. I really needed it.
Did your health hold for the rest of the year?
Yeah, for the, we got a 6 weeks holiday, full pay on 6 weeks. And the whole, we were informed by the pay, the pay corps who were dealing with the money at the hospital, that we would be informed, that we sent by letter how much credits that we had, because we were still on full pay when we were in a prisoner war camp, so I had 18 months pay to come, probably a little over that actually, because we hadn't been paid for a couple of months when we were on training in the Middle East. So I had a fair whack of money to come back to us, but they would send on exact details.